in the excess of 10 dB or 100 dB or 1,000 dB. Okay? But anyway, we can certainly imagine that it makes sense to very, very high energies. And there are two, so let's call that energy scale capital M. Okay? But then the question is, in the low energy theory, we have two relevant operators, two operators of positive dimension. We have the cosmological constant, and we have the Higgs mass squared parameter. Okay, these are two relevant operators, and there's no particular symmetry reason why any of them should be small. Okay, so we would expect lambda to be of order this m to the fourth, and mh squared to be just of order m squared. And if n is way, way above the weak scale, then we have a problem because we have to apparently make unnatural adjustments of the parameters of the theory in order to make this happen. Now, of course, this is a much, much bigger problem. And for the purposes of these lectures, we're going to ignore it. Okay. I don't actually ignore it in my everyday life, but it bothers me and it bothers many of us a hell of a lot. It's a much, much bigger problem. If we put the cutoff here at the Planck scale, this is 120 orders of magnitude too big. This is nearly 30 orders of magnitude too big compared to the weak scale. Okay. And it's even worse because even if we put the cutoff somewhere we've been, like 100 GeV or even the electron mass, this is way, way too big. Okay. But maybe this is mysterious. It has something to do with gravity. So let's ignore this for the moment. This is also a very, very severe problem. Okay. And now, there's a whole variety of exercises that you should do. Really, really, this is just a reflection of the fact that having a small Higgs mass compared to the cutoff requires some unnatural adjustment of the parameters. If you imagine keeping the theory, everything fixed and varying one parameter, like alpha, be very alpha by 10%. Everything changes. The Higgs mass goes all the way up to the scale lambda. And so it really seems to be incredibly finely adjusted in order to have a Higgs, in order for the Higgs to be light. Let me say a few things about it. Of course, there are some obvious ways in which we can have light scalars. For example, we can have a scalar be light if there's a symmetry under phi goes to phi plus constant. If there's a symmetry under phi goes to phi plus constant, then there's no potential allowed at all. And this is indeed exactly the symmetry that makes a scalar field a Goldstone boson. Okay, so the only interactions that are allowed are derivatives of phi. I can have derivative interactions like d phi to the fourth and so on. The problem is that the Higgs doesn't look much like a Goldstone boson because it has lots of interactions, the gauge interactions and the coupling to the top. Both of these interactions very badly break that shift symmetry. And we normally, the real hierarchy puzzle is that there's a relevant operator. There's no reason why that operator should be small. Sometimes the way we phrase it is by drawing the loop diagrams here, drawing diagrams like this or like this. And we notice that these generate things that go like g squared, cutoff squared over 16 pi squared. Or, because there's three colors running around the loop here, 3 lambda top squared over 8 pi squared cutoff squared. This is numerically the biggest of all. This is around 0.3 times the cutoff. I'm calling m scale m here, I guess. 0.3 m squared. Okay? So this loop factor isn't very much. Of course, I can't, but this computation is meaningless. Okay. Every time you have a power divergence in field theory, it just means that the power divergence is totally sensitive to what's going on right at the cutoff. dominated by what's happening at the cutoff. Not like a logarithm. A logarithm is really meaningful. A logarithm gets equal contributions from all scales, from the top to the bottom. That's what a logarithm, that's what a log is. It's integral dt over t. So it gets equal contributions from every decade as you run from a high scale to a low scale. A logarithm is a property of the low energy theory. Logarithms are very meaningful. Every time you see a log, there should be ding, you know. Logs are very exciting, okay? Power divergences are crap. Power divergences are, this is just telling you there's some parameter in the theory, you don't know what it is, okay? You just have to adjust the ultraviolet parameter. And so you just pick the ultraviolet parameter, and there's nothing, this computation is meaningless. There's one thing which is a little meaningful about it, which is the presence of the g's and the lambdas, okay? And only to the following extent. You see, obviously if the g's and the lambdas are zero, then there's no mass. Why is that? That's because as g and lambda are zero, the theory does inherit this shift symmetry, okay? And so you can think of g and lambda as being spurions for the breaking of this shift symmetry, okay? So when we say that this is the size contribution to the Higgs mass, really we're, in the back of our mind, imagining for some reason it's not just m squared. That's the zeroth order problem, okay? So we're imagining, well, maybe for some symmetry reason in the limit as g and lambda goes, lambda top goes to zero, that this thing becomes a Goldstone boson, or it gets this enhanced symmetry. There's no reason for that a priori, but even if that's the case, then there's an inevitable breaking of that, which still gives us a large contribution. And this gives us an idea of an estimate for how big it might be. But it's really not calculable. Okay, I could say a lot more about the tuning puzzles, but let me leave it at that. Okay, so and again, what's interesting here is that we really have something that looks like an elementary scalar. By elementary, I just mean that that the cutoff is significantly above its mass. It's even significantly above the scale of 4 pi b, probably. Okay, so there's really a broad range where this looks like, where this is the correct effective theory, and we have to figure out how to attain these divergences. Okay, well, there's two basic, now we are taking for granted that there is a like Higgs from the last lecture. Of course, the zero possibility is that there's no Higgs at all, the scale 4 pi b, there's strong dynamics, et cetera, et cetera. We've discarded that possibility at the end of last time as being possible, but definitely disfavored. Okay, that would have been like, that would have just been like QCD, like superconductivity, like every other, many, many other times we've seen large hierarchies. We're left with two possibilities then. We've seen, we've still seen something a little like this, even in QCD. So it could be that the Higgs is a Goldstone boson. Okay? It's an approximate Goldstone boson, and then, and that takes you down one set of ideas. They're not really that nice in the end of the day. So let me spend a little bit of time. So there are sort of three historical precedents. Generating large hierarchies. So again, the mystery is where does the weak scale come from if we have much, much larger scales? We have much, much larger scales, and this thing wants to be close to those much larger scales. Okay, the first possibility is it's like the proton, or like the Cooper pair, more like the Cooper pair. Okay, so here there's some theory, there's dimensional transmutation, things go strong at some scale, and that's it. So this we discarded last time because it would mean strong electroweak symmetry breaking. Okay. But we've seen that many times before. We've seen, for example, the charged pion. A charged pion has loop diagrams, very much like the loop diagrams for the Higgs. Okay. And these are going rapidly because I'm trying to get to Susie. Of course, the argument here is that there should be new physics at this scale, new physics new physics before m. Well, that if I don't want this 0.3m squared, if I don't want that to be much larger than the few hundred GeV squared, which is the mass squared of the Higgs, or 200 GeV squared, then m should be less than TeV-ish. So there should be some new physics happening before TeV. That's the argument. Okay. And notice, this is now a much more solid argument for at least the LHC seeing something, because even though it's kind of squishy here, it's not like the dark matter where there's really some relative abundance you can calculate. Okay? Here, this is some requirement of not having unnatural cancellations, and is 10% okay, 1% okay, 30%, you know, there always has that element to it. But an important point is that the largest quadratic divergence of all here is coming from the top quark. This has, among other things, a 3 from color. So it's very reasonable that anything that's going to deal with that quadratic divergence has got to know about that 3 of color. And therefore, it's likely to involve some friend of the top quark, which is also color. Okay? If something is removing this problem, it's likely to require a colored particle. Now, a colored particle lighter than a few TeV, you're cooking with gas. So that's a lot better than a weakly interacting dark matter particle lighter than a few TeV, which is not guaranteed to be seen. Okay. I'm going through this rapidly because I assume many of you have seen this sort of argument before. If not, Graham will do a much better job of it, I assume. Okay. Anyway, so we've seen this before. And here, this idea of naturalness, that we shouldn't have these fine tunings, suggests that we should see some new physics just in order to remove the quadratic divergence for the charge pile. And here it suggests that the physics should come in at a scale less than a GeV or so. And it does. It's the rest of QCD. Okay? It's, in fact, the Rho meson. The Rho meson, in fact, largely cancels this quadratic divergence. Okay? So here's an example where this was an example where you would expect new strong dynamics, and it happens. Here, you expect that you get a light scalar, but that something new should happen before it becomes unnatural, and it does. In fact, not only does it does it rather nicely, even before a GeV. The Rho meson is around 770 MeV, so it's quite natural. Okay? And as I said, going down along these lines makes you think about the Higgs as a composite or Higgs as a pseudo-Goldstone boson. Morally, this is not so different than this. Okay? It is different in the detail, but still, the idea is there is some kind of strong dynamics. Okay, maybe it's not at 1 TeV, it's at 10 TeV. But there's some kind of strong dynamics that produces a cascade of a bunch of lower scales, and we're sitting down at the bottom of that. Okay? So we've had historical precedents for this. These are two cases where naturalness worked beautifully. The third is older, and the theory of, as I mentioned before, of the classical electron. If you have the classical electron, then if you look at the energy stored in the electric field, so since E is E squared over R, E over R squared, the energy stored in the electric field is linearly divergent as you integrate the small sizes, and if you cut it off at a scale A, it's given by E squared over A. Now, so the people thinking about this said that something new has got to happen before a very, very tiny length. The tiny length they call the classical electron radius, which is when E squared over A becomes comparable to mc squared, or when A is E squared over mc squared. Okay? So these people said that something new had better happen at larger distances than that, because otherwise the energy stored in the electron, the electric field of the electron would be vastly larger than the mass of the electron itself. And you'd have to have some kind of cancellation between different contributions to the mass of the electron, and even somehow the negative contributions is even more confusing to them, in order to remove this. Okay? So again, just like the Higgs, there are some contributions that are very, very large, and so we say there's got to be something new so that to evade this conclusion. Now here, the answer was, so what did they do? They did all sorts of dumb things They built, they tried to make the electron actually have a finite size of around that size, and anyway. So none of that worked, because the right answer was quantum mechanics. The right answer is that at a distance of order the Compton wavelength of the electron, you start seeing electron-positron pairs around this guy. Okay? And so because of that, you actually don't know which the central electron is. Okay? There's just the cloud of E plus, E minus, and the single additional electron. But that effectively fuzzes out the size at a distance of order h bar over mc. And note, h bar over mc is parametrically larger than that scale. H bar over mc is parametrically larger than e squared over mc squared. Okay. To the extent that 1 is parametrically larger than e squared over h bar c, which is alpha. So there's a new dimensionless parameter in town, a small dimensionless parameter. The theory is weakly coupled. Okay. And that means that here is the scale at which you needed something new to happen, the classical radius of the electron. The actual scale where something new happened was parametrically larger. So something new happened earlier at 1 over alpha a classical. Okay. So here's another case now where something much more dramatic happened. There was a hierarchy puzzle, and it was resolved by very new physics, in this case the existence of antimatter, the fact that quantum mechanics and relativity forces you to have antiparticles, and so this extension of space-time symmetry together with quantum mechanics doubled the world, removed this divergence, and okay, that's pretty high drawing. Okay. So here are three cases from the last 100 years where this idea of naturalness either was or could have been applied and was exactly correct. And not only in all the cases, not only is it correct, things came in before they had to come. So again, in this case, there's one scale, everything is strongly interacting, totally fine. In this case, numerically, notice that things needed to come in at 1 GeV and they came in at 770. That might seem like it's not a big deal. Actually, this is something parametric. It's that QCD is almost a large N theory, and it's weakly coupled at large N. So the reason the Romanzon is a little light is probably because n equals 3 is a little big, and this fact is actually 1 over square root 3. Okay, so that should be 1 over root n, so it is parametric, actually. And it works, came in beforehand. And finally, another example where there was a puzzle, it was solved and it came in beforehand. Okay, in all cases, things came in at the scale bigger by some weak coupling factor, by some inverse weak coupling factor. Here, there is no weak coupling factor because the theory is strongly coupled. And in both of these cases, there was. And the problem was solved just manifestly. Nobody was arguing in, 1935 about, well, maybe there's a contribution to the electron mass. It's not, there was no debate about whether 10% tuning was OK for the electron mass. The problem was just solved, full stop, no opportunity even for there to be an issue of debate. Okay, so supersymmetry is the moral equivalent of this one, for obvious reasons. Okay. It's an extension of the space-time symmetry that doubles the number of degrees of freedom and solves these puzzles. As we'll see in the last lectures, the difficulty and the reason why there is such an active field of supersymmetry phenomenology and everything hasn't just been solved is that there is a tension. And the tension is that supersymmetry does not appear to be solving these hierarchy puzzles in the same very definitive, clear way as its antecedents. Okay. But we'll see what to make of that, if it's a big deal or not. We'll talk about it. Okay, so now let's actually start talking about supersymmetry. So the idea, before I go on, let me say a little more conceptually why it is that we have this trouble with scalars. So we've said it in this language of, well, we can't find any symmetries to prohibit the mass. That's a little bit technical. Let's see if there's a better way of saying it. And the better way of saying it is that for every spin other than spin zero, there is actually a discontinuous difference between zero and non-zero mass. There's something special about massless particles. And that's because massless particles with spin have helicity. So let's say you have a charged massless fermion. Let's say we had a massless electron. Let's ignore the electron mass for a second. Then if I have an electron, it has helicity. Okay? So it has helicity, moves at the speed of light. It has helicity, let's say a left helicity. And that's really one degree of freedom. Well, maybe two. There's this antiparticle, but its antiparticle has right helicity. Okay, so I can have a positron with right helicity. Now, I can also have totally separately, I can have a right helicity electron and its antiparticle. But these things are logically independent. It's possible to just have these degrees of freedom and these degrees of freedom. Now, when you have an electron mass, there's a frame in which you can make the electron point any way you want. So the mass term forces both of these degrees of freedom to exist. Okay? But in limit where there's no mass, really I can imagine two completely decoupled worlds with just these two or just those two. And there's really a discontinuous difference. I go from having 2 to 4 degrees of freedom if I insist on two sets of totally decoupled degrees of freedom to 4 when I turn on the mass. So that's the physical reason that we say more mathematically, where we say that the electron mass is prohibited by a chiral symmetry. Okay? We say that the mass, I'll very briefly review about fermions in a second, but when we work down a mass term like this for the electron, again, it's really because as m goes to zero, I have fewer degrees of freedom. Okay? Now, here I really have the same 4 degrees of freedom, but they really break up completely into 2 separate sets. Similarly for spin 1. For spin 1, I just have helicity. Okay? Again, for all spins, I just have helicity. So a spin 1, again, just has helicity. And now, again, there's a discontinuous difference between zero and non-zero mass. Okay, go from having 2 to 3 degrees of freedom. So often we say, so here there's a genuine global symmetry. As m goes to zero, I have a chiral symmetry which rotates E and E conjugate. Here we often say that there's a symmetry that ensures that the massless spin 1 particle is massless and its gauge invariance. And again, not to beat a dead horse, that's completely backwards. There's no such thing as a gauge invariance. What there is that there's a discontinuous difference between 2 and 3 degrees of freedom. Okay? So there's no interaction, nothing. Okay, if I start with 2 degrees of freedom, I'm not going to make a third degree of freedom out of nowhere. And that's why nothing I do will ever generate a mass for a massless spin 1 particle, though it's tautological. Okay? So, but really the point is that there's a discontinuous difference. There's a degree of freedom difference between massless and massive. So that's for spin 1/2, spin 1, spin 3/2, all higher spins, there is a discontinuous difference between spin 0 and between massless and massive. There isn't for spin 0. Okay? So spin 0 is the same number of degrees of freedom, whether it's massless or massive. And that's why we can't. That's why it's not natural for it to be light, unless it's a Goldstone boson or it has another reason to be massless. Okay. So the idea of a supersymmetry is to imagine that scalars and fermions are put into multiplets with each other. Okay, so you want something that will guarantee that the scalar is massless, even when it has interactions and everything else. And so the idea is to imagine having scalars and fermions in multiplex with each other, so that the symmetries that protect the fermions, well, through supersymmetry, also protect the scalars. Okay. So let's see. Oh, so sorry. Before I proceed, let me just have a very quick aside. This is, I'm talking about biospinners, because we're going to be using this notation throughout, and if you're not familiar with it, it's the right way to think about spinners, so you should become familiar with it. So biospinners are actually the tiniest representation of the Lorentz group. They're really the building block out of which we make everything else. The easiest way to see what they are is to mimic the way you've probably seen spinners talked about in undergraduate quantum mechanics, except now do it in Minkowski space. You remember, if you have some vector in three dimensions, if we take the Pauli spin matrices dot x, then, well, this is x3 minus x3, x1 minus x2, x1 plus ix2. Let me call this vector capital X. I'll call this matrix capital X. And you'll notice that the determinant of capital X is just minus x squared. x3 squared minus x1 squared minus x2 squared. Okay. So that unitary transformation, and that this is the most general traceless Hermitian matrix. So if I do unitary transformations on X, this I can write as some, so let me call this X prime. Since X prime is still traceless in Hermitian, I can rewrite X prime as sigma dot little x prime. And since the determinant of X prime is equal to the determinant of X, that means that the length of X prime is equal to the length of X, and therefore X prime is a rotation on X. The rotation depends on u. So this explicitly gives us a two-dimensional representation of rotations in terms of the u's. So ordinary spinners are then things that transform just under this two-dimensional rotation. All right, so if we do this in Minkowski space, it's exactly the same. Now let's look at the set of matrices 1 and sigma, which I'll call sigma mu. Now, if I look at a four-vector x mu, and I look at sigma mu x mu, if I call this capital X again, this is now x0 plus x3, x0 minus x3, x1 minus ix2, x1 plus ix2. Once again, the determinant of x, it is now x0 squared minus x squared. So this is the Lorentz length, four length. Okay, now this is a general, this is no longer traceless, it's a general 2x2 matrix. Okay, so again, I can write the x prime is sigma mu x prime mu, and so x prime is some Lorentz transformation that depends on mu on x. Oh, sorry. I didn't talk about you yet. Sorry. So now let me look at a totally general. Let me put x prime is L dagger XL, where L is any 2x2 complex matrix. Okay. The unit, we can take it to have unit determinant for obvious reasons, but so this is inside the SL2C. Okay, so this continues to be traceless. It continues to be Hermitian. The determinant is conserved again, so that x prime mu is, again, some Lorentz transformation that depends on L times x nu. But now I have a two-dimensional representation where if I have some, I have a spinner psi, it transforms like L alpha beta psi beta. And I can take its complex conjugate, which by convention, when I complex conjugate, I call the corresponding indices dotted indices alpha dot, and this goes to L star alpha dot, psi bar, beta dot. So this shows that I have two-dimensional representation of the Lorentz group. And because the L has unit determinant, epsilon alpha beta and epsilon alpha dot are invariant tensors. So again, given a general vector x mu, sigma mu then clearly transforms as a matrix with an alpha and an alpha dot index because it's being acted on by L dagger and by L. So using this, using sigma, I can, for example, convert, I can define an x alpha dot is sigma mu alpha dot x mu. So I can trade, so I can trade a mu index for an alpha and an alpha dot index. Or I can reverse it and write x mu as sig mu, as sigma mu, let me introduce some more notation. So the epsilons are invariant tensors, so I can use them to raise and lower indices. So for example, I can define something called sigma bar, which has an alpha dot beta index, which is just raising the indices of sigma. And so I can also then write x mu as a half sigma bar mu alpha alpha dot, where the half is there because the trace of sigma squared is 2. Okay. So the size, so these are the minimal, representations of the Lorentz group. Oh, and I can make very simple invariants by just contracting. So if I have two spinners, psi and chi, well, so I can have epsilon alpha beta, psi alpha, chi beta, which I'll abbreviate as psi chi. Now, if the psi's are numbers, if they're numbers, this is clearly equal to minus epsilon alpha beta, chi alpha, psi beta, for numbers, for C numbers. But we're interested in the case also, and when we write down fields, where these fields are Grassmann. Okay, and when they're Grassmann, I flip sign again, and so in fact psi chi is equal to chi psi for Grassmann psi and chi. So that's a very simple invariant. Similarly, I can have psi bar chi bar, plus chi bar psi bar. So this is the minimal two-dimensional representation, spinorial representation of the Lorentz group. And so if I want to build a field, a fermionic field, is enough to just have one of them. So I can have a theory of a single, these are called Weyl fermion, single Weyl fermion, psi alpha. So two-dimensional, 2D spinner, so you know this is really psi 1, psi 2. Okay. So let's write down, what do you think the Lagrangian is going to be for this guy? Well, I can have, we know it's fermionic, it's going to have one derivative, so it looks like For example, psi bar alpha dot, sigma bar mu, alpha dot alpha, d mu, psi. So there I've shown all the indices very explicitly. So often I will abbreviate this as psi bar I, sigma bar mu, d mu, psi. Note, if we want to be a little, we can make these things look nicer by purely using dot indices. For instance, this is the same as psi bar alpha dot, I, d alpha dot alpha, psi alpha. Okay? By my definition of how to go from vectors to by spinners and vice versa. Okay. So that is the theory of a single Biot spinner. Massless. The equation of motion is just from either form that sigma bar p psi equals zero. If I go to momentum space. And so this is either p0 plus p3 or p0 minus p3. If I have something moving in the z direction, psi equals 0. And so the solutions are either plus or minus helicity. They are sigma dot p hat psi is minus psi. Is psi for p0 equals p, and the other way around, sigma dot p hat psi equals minus psi for p0 equals minus p. Okay. This is a theory of a single Biot spinner. So the field psi alpha destroys left-handed particles. It creates right-handed antiparticles. Okay, so it's only 2 degrees of freedom. And in fact, if we, just to emphasize this point, let me just tell you. Well, actually, let me keep going and talk about more general theories first. Okay. Note that, okay, so that's a single Biot fermion. Let's now try to think about a massive fermion. So we have a couple of choices here. One thing we could do is take this Lagrangian that we have, and I can just add to it a half m psi psi plus Hermitian conjugate. Okay, so psi psi is an invariant. Okay. It doesn't vanish for Grassmann, and so this is clearly adding a mass term. Now you notice that this mass term destroys the symmetry under which psi is charged. Okay, so this breaks the symmetry under which psi is charged. So that means that this mass term breaks any notion of that there's no charge associated with the particle created by psi. Okay? Because the mass term just breaks it. Something else we can do, so this ends up being a Majorana fermion. Something else we can do is to have two kinds of fields, psi, psi 1 and psi 2, or I'll call them psi and psi conjugate. These are just two completely independent Biot fermions. The C here is just think about them as two different labels, okay? But now I can add a mass term that looks like M psi psi conjugate. And this now preserves the symmetry under psi goes to either the I alpha psi, and psi conjugate goes to either the minus alpha psi conjugate. Okay? So this is a theory of still two massive degrees of freedom, but before we had a left particle and a right antiparticle, but the antiparticle doesn't carry any charges distinct from the particle. So it's really a left particle and a right particle, 2 degrees of freedom. This is a theory that has 4 degrees of freedom. It has the 4 degrees of freedom of the 2 degrees of freedom of this guy, the left particle and the right empty particle. A different left particle and a different right empty particle. And then a mass term that mixes none. So it's 4 degrees of freedom. Okay. All right. This is the thing which allows you to group things together into a Dirac spinner. So when I have that, I can rewrite the action as psi Dirac bar I gamma mu d mu minus or plus m or whatever minus m. Psi Dirac, where psi Dirac is now a four-component object whose upper two components are psi alpha and whose lower two components are psi conjugate bar alpha dot. Okay, so we can group them together like this. Oh, and the gamma mu's are 0, sigma mu, sigma bar mu, and 0. Okay, so that's the relation to the familiar Dirac spinners. But I will never, ever use this notation again because it's totally stupid. In every theory that we care about, first of all, the left and right hand. So why is this useful? It's useful in theories where there's a symmetry that flips psi and psi conjugate. So psi and psi conjugate are two totally different spinners, but it might be that there's a symmetry that flips them. If there's a symmetry that flips them, that's parity. And in that case, it's convenient to group them in a way that makes that more obvious. But it's also useful when you're interested in low-energy physics, where the mass term matters. Okay? But in high-energy physics, we're interested in high-energy physics. So the mass is mostly irrelevant. And the left and right components are treated very differently. The theories are chiral. So it's totally stupid to work in terms of Dirac spinners. These are the logically simplest things. These are what the theory is built out of. And that's what we will use. Okay. The only reason people sometimes give for not using Dirac spinners is that you can't find the Feynman rules for Weyl spinners conveniently available. And therefore, I'll just give them to you, because they're much simpler than they're much simpler even than the familiar ones. They're simpler because you don't have to carry anything 4x4 around in your head. Everything is 2x2. Okay? So in the end, even if you have some spinner product and you're really lazy, you just multiply it out by hand. If you're really lazy, you just multiply it out by hand. And you never, ever have to. Okay, so first, let's now talk about the. All right, actually, you know what? Let me just tell you what. So let's say we have a psi bar propagator. So I'm going to show you what the Feynman rules look like. So this has an alpha and an alpha dot index. All right. Well, this is very easy. What could this be? This could only be I p alpha alpha dot over p squared minus m squared. Okay. We can also have psi conjugate type propagators. And I'm going to include the case, and it's the same, when psi conjugate is the same as psi. So we can treat these things the same. This is, so this has an alpha and a beta index. And so this is I delta alpha beta over p squared minus m squared. Okay. And the vertices you just read off as usual. So let's say I have a scalar field and it interacts with two Weyl fermions. Okay. Well, then there's a vertex that looks like phi, psi, psi. And so I just associate. Okay. So everything else is normal. The last thing you need to know is what wave functions to associate with the external legs. I actually have them, but I think what I'll do is make you do it. So let me make you do it.
and two pound. Let me just tell you what they are, and then spend my time on this. But then, as punishment, you'll have to do some complicated bounding diagram. Okay? So here's how you read off the wave functions. I'm just telling you what the how you decompose the actual field psi alpha is an integral. This is just a convenient way of writing. So there's a root E plus P chi plus A plus M over root E plus P chi minus A minus e to the minus IPX plus root E plus P chi plus A minus conjugate dagger minus IPX. Okay. So that's psi alpha, psi conjugate. Alpha is same with A and A conjugate flipped. For a Majorana fermion, it's the same with A and A conjugate identified. Okay. And now this tells you every, oh, and the chis are, again, sigma dot p hat, chi plus minus is plus minus chi plus minus. Okay. So A plus destroys a positive helicity, destroys a left helicity particle. A minus destroys a right helicity particle. So psi destroys left helicity particles, and with a small amplitude proportional to m, also right helicity particles, and the other way around. In the massless limit, this is very simple. In the massless limit, it's just root e plus b chi plus a plus e to the minus I x and a minus conjugate dagger to the IPX. So when you have a specific initial state or final state, you have to match on. You draw the Feynman diagram, and you've got to attach the wave function factors. Well, if you have a left helicity incoming particle, you have to destroy it, so you attach that factor to it. A right helicity incoming particle, that one, and so on. So this is all the information you need. This is the analog of the U bars and V bars, except for two-component notation. It's completely trivial. So there's no U bar, V bar crap, and whenever you want to compute any amplitude, in fact, there's even slightly slicker things that you can do, but you can just multiply two by two stuff out by here. Anyway, I'll give you an exercise like that for your problem. Okay, so now we know all about file fermions. Let's start talking about Susan. I'm losing my chart. Okay. So let's first try to guess what the simplest possible theory is that would be supersymmetric. Well, if you haven't written that down, I'll write it back down for you for your exercise. That'll give you a hard question. Okay. So what is the simplest possible theory that might be supersymmetric? It had better have the same number of boson and fermion degrees of freedom. We're going to put bosons and fermions in a multiplet together. The simplest fermions is a vial spinner, single massless vial spinner. So how many degrees of freedom should the boson have? Two. Right. So let's have a complex scalar phi. And so let's try the dumbest thing possible, d mu phi star d mu phi plus psi bar I sigma bar d psi. Okay. This is a theory. It's free. And it has two fermionic degrees of freedom, two scalar degrees of freedom. If there's any such thing as supersymmetry, it should show up here. Okay? All right, let's actually do one more example. There's a slightly more clever thing that we can do. Which is, what if we started with a theory with a gauge field? Example one. Example two, a theory of the gauge field. is that. And so how many degrees of freedom does a gauge shield have? Physical degrees of freedom. Two again. So that's also the same as the number of degrees of freedom of a vial fermion. Okay. That's a little bit of magic that only happens in a certain number of dimensions. For example, it happens in 4 dimensions, in 10 dimensions. So anyway, let's do it. Okay, so here are two candidate theories that might be supersymmetric. Okay, let's see what that supersymmetry might be. So it should be something which mixes up phi and psi in some way, right? Because it's got to put them in a multiplet. So somehow you want something that's going to rotate phi into psi and psi back into phi. Okay. So let's start off being as naive as possible. What is the variation of psi? What could it possibly be? Okay. Well, I want it to be somehow rotated into psi, right? Okay. So let me write down a psi alpha here. Okay, well, I have some Lorentz trouble. So how can I make this Lorentz invariant? My transforming parameter, let's call it zeta, c, psi. I'm sorry. I had a professor who taught two complex variables as an undergraduate who was 90 years old and kept talking about functions of z and zeta. So I'm traumatized forever. Okay, so that's the simplest thing we can do, right? Can anyone think of something simpler we can do? I hope not, because then I have to do it up here. But I doubt it. Okay, well, let's do a little bit of dimensional analysis. Phi has mass dimension 1, psi has mass dimension 3/2, so xi has got to have mass dimension minus 1/2. Okay, very good. So let's keep going. What could delta vc alpha possibly look like? Well, one thing we know we need on the right-hand side is a phi, right? Because it's got to rotate it back into phi. Okay. It's probably got to have xi there somewhere, right? Because that's the parameter. The parameter of the, so xi is, this is the parameter of the Suzy transformation. So it should be a xi here somewhere. Let's just write it down. Okay. Hey, that looks pretty nice. But there's a small problem. The dimensions aren't working, right? So that's 3/2. That's minus 1/2. So this thing, whatever it is got to have mass dimension 2 and not 1. So what do I do? Huh? A derivative is a good idea. Okay? So let's try adding a d mu here. Okay. Now things really suck. except remember that the mu and alphas and alpha dots can be traded for each other. But in fact it tells me what I have to do. You see, what I need is something that would look like a zeta bar alpha dot, sigma bar mu alpha dot alpha d mu phi. Okay? That's the only thing I can do. And this would have been simpler, again, if we used alpha-alpha dot indices. So with alpha-alpha dot indices, this has an alpha and an alpha dot index. This thing has an alpha index, so I need whatever else it is, it's got to have an alpha dot index. Okay, so let's try this. So I've picked the coefficient here, 1. Okay, just by convention. So let me put an arbitrary coefficient in front of this transformation. Let's call it C. And we can write it anyway. Let's write it in. I'm a fan of this today, so we'll do that. Okay. Okay, so that's the only thing it could be, right? That's what the simplest possible thing could be. And now we can ask whether this free Lagrangian is invariant. For some choice of C. is it possible to choose a transformation so that it's invariant? Of course, the answer is yes. And in order to do it and not drown in a sea of indices, let me just immediately go to a, this is just for my convenience. It really doesn't matter. But let me go to a momentum space. So if I go to momentum space, the same Lagrangian becomes p squared 5 star minus p 5 p, momentum is conserved, okay, plus psi bar minus p alpha dot alpha, psi alpha of p. Okay. And so we see that if delta phi p is equal to zeta alpha psi alpha p, and delta zeta bar delta psi alpha is some constant zeta bar alpha dot p alpha dot alpha phi, oh, by the way, I should have said one quick thing. Why did I not write down things involving psi bar here, or phi star here? Okay. The reason I didn't is, first of all, it wouldn't work. But also, there's a motivation for it. Remember, we want the chiral symmetry that acts on psi. Ultimately, we want to have a theory that puts psi's and phi's together. But the chiral symmetry that acts on the fermions are protecting the scalars. So here, there is a natural U1 symmetry that acts on the psi's and on the phi's. And I don't want to break that U1 symmetry. So I make a choice by putting psi here. Now I say psi and phi have the same charges under that other U1. And so then I have to have phi's here and not phi stars. The ultimate Suzy theory, this is an R symmetry, but anyway, we'll get to that in a second. OK, well, let's just see if it's possible. OK, it's more or less obvious that it's possible, right? So if I take the variation of the first term, for example, I get p squared phi minus p star zeta psi p. And if I look at the bar variation on the second term, I get the I get minus I get plus c times, oh, so let me just, so plus the Hermitian conjugate, so plus p squared zeta bar psi bar minus p times phi p. And now let me, this is plus c. If I take the variation of psi from here, I get psi bar minus p, p alpha alpha dot, and then I get p alpha dot alpha phi. But p alpha dot alpha, that's nothing other than p squared. That's p squared times with the zeta, I guess. Plus the Hermitian conjugate. So you see that this is exactly the same as that. So if I choose c equals minus 1, I'm done. Oh, sorry. Let me put an I. I put an I there so that just turned into a P on the other side. Okay. So, No. I'm not putting anything on shell. I just went to momentum space. I didn't have to do it. I could have done position space, so it's easier for me to look at P's than D's. I don't know why. All right. Very good. So we actually found in this free massless theory, we found a supersymmetry. I can write it back in position space, and conventionally people put a root 2 in front of it. They just rescale their c's differently than me. Okay. And so let me just. Okay. Now, in practice, you will never have to remember these transformation laws or anything. Okay? If you know them, shame on you. You should remember, this is the way I remember them. Okay? No indices, no nothing. It's just that delta phi is proportional to psi, and delta psi has got a zeta bar d phi. Okay? This is the way to remember things. And then the indices just come along for the ride the only way they can. Okay? Okay? All right. Now, what about the other Lagrangian? The other Lagrangian was also interesting. The other Lagrangian was minus a quarter f mu squared plus lambda. Okay? And now, this is interesting because let's say I want to look at because f mu nu, see, any variation of lambda should somehow have to do with f. F mu nu is gauge invariant. Okay? Lambda doesn't have any charge, so lambda is some gauge invariant thing. F mu nu is gauge invariant. So any variation of lambda has got to involve f, or the variations of f have got to involve lambda. But nowhere am I going to talk about a mu directly, okay? When I'm talking about these variations. Okay, so that's interesting because remember in the previous case we started off with delta phi being zeta psi, but we can't do the same thing. It can't be that delta of the boson is zeta times the fermion. It can't because the dimensions don't work. Okay, f mu nu is dimension 2, zeta is dimension minus a half, this is dimension 3/2, so this doesn't work. Okay? Instead, what does work is for the guess to be the other way around, so for delta lambda to go like zeta f. Those dimensions work. Okay? This is 2, this is 3/2, that's minus a half. That's 2. Okay? And therefore, delta f should look like what? So delta f should look like zeta d lambda, roughly. Okay? That's also what makes the dimensions work. Okay? 2 minus a half, 1, 3 halves. Okay, so let's try to gussy up these formulas with indices. Again, that's the only way to do it is just to remember how it works dimensionally, and then if the indices follow the only way they can. Okay, so delta lambda should equal, has an alpha index. There should be something involving f mu nu. So I want to have like a zeta. I need to have a zeta here, but this has some mu nu indices. So they're contracted with sigma mu nu, which I'll tell you what it is in a second. Okay, so sigma mu nu is sigma, well, it's just sigma mu, sigma bar nu, has an alpha beta index. Okay. This is sigma mu, alpha beta dot, sigma bar, beta dot, gamma. Okay? So it has an alpha beta index. And I can anti-symmetrize it. So if I symmetrize it, sigma mu, sigma bar nu plus mu to nu is 2 eta mu nu. That's the analog of the gamma mu, gamma nu anti-commutator formula. But the other way around, sigma mu, sigma bar nu minus sigma nu, sigma bar nu is sigma mu nu. Okay, and that's an interesting anti-symmetric tensor. And it has to be an anti-symmetric tensor in order to marry it up with F. Okay, so that's the only possible transformation law for lambda. And then the transformation for F is again the only one that it can be, and I'll just write it down. So delta of f mu nu is zeta sigma nu d mu lambda bar. Now f mu is real, so anything I do here has to have plus Hermitian conjugate. And it's got to be anti-symmetric in mu and nu, so let me subtract mu and nu. Okay, so this is the only possible transformation model that I could have for this Lagrangian, just consistent with dimensional analysis. And once again, you can check that it's invariant. Yes?
Why is there no psi bar term in delta lambda?
Why is there no psi bar term in, well, because it's a delta lambda alpha.
Okay? But if I do sigma bar, then if I use sigma bar mu nu.
Yes, but you need to get rid of two f mu nu indices. Okay. So I need lambda to go into f mu nu.
Psi
yeah.
bar and sigma bar mu nu.
There's no. I'm sorry. Yes. I'm sorry. So that's actually a well. If I did that, that would be delta for lambda bar. So if I had sigma bar. If I had C bar, sigma bar, mu nu, then that whole thing would have an alpha dot index. And that would be delta lambda bar alpha dot. Okay. All right, so these are two free theories, and they have two supersymmetries. We found that they have symmetries that rotate the bosons into the fermions. Now, what about interacting theories? So once again, let's start off by trying to guess the answer. I'm not going to get far with these sigma and sigma bars. OK, let's go back to our simplest theory, which was d phi star d phi. I don't know, half plus psi bar I sigma bar d psi. Okay? And now let's add the simplest interactions that we can. Okay? Well, the simplest interactions that we can add, which are dimensionless, so marginal interactions, normalizable, whatever you want to call it. And let me still try not to break this U1 symmetry that acts on psi and phi. Okay? Let me just restrict myself to that. Well, I can write down psi phi. Okay? Let's make that coefficient and call it something, h. That's a Yukawa coupling between phi and psi. Okay? That's the simplest thing I can write down, simplest interaction between the fermions. And something else I can write is a potential. Let me write it as lambda over 2, phi squared, phi star squared. Okay? And again, I don't have phi cubed, phi star, and so on, because I want to keep the U1 symmetry. All right, so this is a theory. When these couplings are zero, it has a supersymmetry. So let's see if it's even possible for it to have a supersymmetry when the couplings are not zero. Well, clearly, just intuitively, clearly, supersymmetry has got to relate these couplings to each other somehow. Okay? Because supersymmetry is rotating phi into psi. What's not obvious is that somehow, if it's rotating phi into psi, how is it going to create something with four things from something with three things again. Okay? So let's ignore that for a second and just ask more physically. If this theory is supersymmetric, it had better be that, for example, even at loop level, the scalar and the fermion are degenerate. Okay. Right? Now the fermion is massless. The fermion is massless because I have not broken the chiral symmetry that acts on the fermion. Okay. I have psi goes to, that was the point we just said, phi goes to e to the minus 2 I alpha phi. This is a good symmetry. So there's no fermion mass. The fermion has got to be massless. That means that the scalar should be massless too. Massless fermion. Massless scalar. But that's very dangerous. Of course, we have the classic hierarchy problem diagrams, right? So we have this interaction between phi, phi star, psi, psi. And I have this one. Okay. They're both quadratically divergent. This one is proportional to h squared, and this one is proportional to lambda. Okay? But it's clear that for some choice of lambda proportional to h squared, these two things can be made to cancel exactly. Okay? So for lambda equals some number times h squared, as it turns out that number is a half. And that's an exercise for you to do. This contribution cancels exactly. Okay? Now that doesn't prove that that theory is supersymmetric. It has a supersymmetric. It proves every other choice cannot possibly be supersymmetric. It proves that. Okay? If it was going to be supersymmetric, it would only be for this choice. Now something else you can do is also to see if this is just, after all, can't you just call this fine-tuning? I'm just choosing lambda to equal h squared, right, to cancel this quadratic divergence. And all these silly things have been said to the standard model by Veltman, for example, okay, who calls it the Veltman condition or something, where he says you can choose the parameters to make the quadratic divergences cancel. Yes, it's true, but it's not deep. And one way you see that it's not deep is that that relationship between the couplings isn't valid at all scales. If you have a symmetry that relates couplings, then that relationship between them is preserved at every scale. Okay? So if there's a symmetry here for the choice that we determine from canceling these quadratic divergences, you should find that that relationship, lambda is equal to half h squared, is preserved by renormalization group evolution. So that's something that you could check. You could compute the RGEs for H, you could compute the RGEs for lambda, and see, is lambda equal to half H squared, is that preserved under RG? Of course, the answer you will find, that's another exercise you should do, is yes, it's preserved under RG. So now you have two, now it's really starting to smell like there's a reason why this is happening. Okay, there's a choice of parameters that makes the quadratic divergence go away, and that relationship between parameters is RG invariant. So that makes you suspect that here there is that there might be some kind of supersymmetry for this choice of parameters. Okay? Okay, so that's our guess for this theory. Let's keep going and make other guesses. So let's go to our. But I just want to point out the obvious thing that Suzy is clearly relating couplings to each other. Here it's relating a Yukawa coupling to a quartic cell coupling. All right, let's go to our second theory, r minus a quarter f mu squared plus lambda bar sigma bar d lambda. Now, what is the most natural way of coupling something to this? Well, the most natural way of coupling something to this is to add fields that are charged under this U1. Okay. Now, if I'm going to add fields that are charged under the U1, probably the most natural thing to add are these guys. Okay? Because I want the new things to also be supersymmetric multiplets. So let me add a charged psi. So I'll add psi bar I sigma bar mu d mu psi plus d mu phi star d mu phi, where psi and phi have the same charge. Say charge one. Okay? Okay. Now, well, we know that what happens here is that if I put the gauge coupling down there, it's natural to put a 1 over g squared down here, too. Okay, so let me just do that, because I want to imagine the theory treating them the same. Right? Okay, but I know that the coefficient of f mu squared runs. Right? It runs from loop diagrams involving the scalars and the fermions. Right? So, well, if that's going to run, then it had better be that the wave function renormalization
of lambda also runs in exactly the same way. But as it is, there's no wave function normalization at all for lambda. So I have to write down some interactions for lambda between lambda and these guys. Now, what is the only interaction I can write down between lambda and these guys, which has the same dimensions as a coupling constant? It's a Yukawa coupling, right? So I can have something like lambda psi, okay, to contract Lorentz indices. Now, and then I have to have a phi star in order for this to be U1 invariant. So I can have some kind of coupling constant like this, a Yukawa coupling like this. So just as I have a coupling between the gauge field and the scalars, I can have a coupling between the gaugino, the partner of the gauge field, and a fermion and the star scalar. Now, clearly, H has got to be related to G in some way. Okay? H should be proportional to G. So I need to have H is equal to G times some number in order for the wave function normalization that I get from these diagrams, for example, in order for that to be the same as these, I have to have H is equal to the gauge coupling times some number. So that's a new interaction that I'm supposed to add. This is a supersymmetric counterpart to the gauge coupling. Okay, it's an interaction between the gaugino, the super partner, and the field. There's one other possible interaction that I might need. Let me go back and look at the scalar again. The scalar's mass should again vanish. Okay? But now the scalar is receiving contributions from the gauge field, from the gaugino now, with this new interaction that we have involving lambda and psi and phi. Well, it's possible that there's one more interaction. Maybe this coefficient will be zero. We'll have to find out. But it's possible there's another interaction that will be needed, another possible quadratic divergence would involve a new scalar self-interaction, phi squared, phi star squared. And this coefficient would have to be some number times g squared. Okay. So to make this theory supersymmetric, there has to be some particular number times g squared in front of this phi star squared, phi squared potential. There has to be some particular number times g for these Yukawa couplings. And so perhaps for some particular choice of those numbers, the theory will be supersymmetric. Okay. Once again, we see that there's relations between there's relations here between the Yukawa coupling and the gauge coupling. Here are the relations between the Yukawa coupling and the quartic coupling. So if supersymmetry exists, it has to somehow non-trivially relate all these coupling constants to each other. Okay. Very good. Okay, so now in order to more systematically try to build these theories, then it's useful to try to understand the supersymmetry that we discovered for free theories in a more transparent way. So by the way, for this example, you can really do it. You can really find that coefficient, and it's very easy to check that it's RG invariant. So that's you can even do it for these examples. But let's try to really see the symmetry as cleanly as possible. Now, supersymmetry is clearly some kind of space-time symmetry. It's relating particles of different spin to each other. And we can get a clue as to what that. Now, what are other space-time symmetries that we know? Things like translations, rotations.
it would be nice to try to cast this, the symmetry that we found, in a way that has a more of a space-time picture. And we even, as I said, we didn't get a clue, because remember, this transformation parameter c to alpha, it's, what were its units? Its units were minus a half, right? So it has units of the square root of a length. Now, remember, if we have x mu, which is a coordinate, ordinary coordinate, I can also write it as an x alpha alpha dot. Okay. And when you write it as an x alpha alpha dot, it sort of begs itself to be also thought of as a product of something with an alpha and an alpha dot index. And the things with an alpha and an alpha dot index would then have units of square root of length. So it's natural to have objects with units square root length, which carry an alpha and an alpha dot index, so that x mu itself is something which has units length and carries both. Okay, so this leads us to introduce the idea of superspace. So let's say, in addition to x mu or x alpha alpha dot, we also have two Grassmann coordinates, theta and theta bar. So a point in superspace is then labeled by x mu, theta, and theta bar. Or again, x alpha alpha dot, theta alpha, or theta bar alpha. Now, clearly, we can have just ordinary translations in superspace. X mu goes to X mu plus a constant. But we can have more interesting kind of translation in superspace. So let's imagine translating theta. So it had the same units as our C from before. But now we can make an interesting transformation on the x alpha alpha dot, which is that we can have it go to something that looks like zeta bar alpha dot theta alpha, and sometimes people conventionally put an I here, minus I theta bar alpha dot. So this is something that we can do. This is another translation in superspace. It translates the thetas and the x's in this way. Okay, this is clearly a well-defined operation. I can do this twice, and I get another thing back of the same form, and so on. Okay, so this is a well-defined, it's a well-defined set of transformations. Okay, this is supersymmetry. SUSY is translation in superspace. And so, for example, let's say I have a field which is a function of x, theta, and theta bar. Any field is a function of x, theta, and theta bar. Now, what does it mean that it's a function of x, theta, and theta bar? Well, I can do a Taylor expansion in theta and theta bar. So it can have a component which we would call f0, which is the lowest component. It can have a component f sub theta times theta alpha plus something else. You know, it can have things that look like theta alpha, theta bar alpha dot, a component which is f alpha alpha dot, theta theta bar, and so on. The highest component it can have is something that has two thetas and two theta bars, because theta cubed and higher vanishes. Theta is a Grassmann variable. There's only two thetas, so any more than two thetas producted together vanish. Anyway, so I can take some general function. I can always Taylor expand it in this way if I like. But there's a way to be guaranteed to have a supersymmetric
action or a supersymmetric interaction. Remember, SUSY is translation in superspace. So if I take an action, which is an integral over x, the thetas, so these are Grassmann integrals now, theta bars of f, this is obviously supersymmetric. Because it's obviously translationally invariant. Okay. Now, these Grassmann integrals, as usual, kill the things that they integrate. So this actually just picks out this highest component of f, because everything else gives me 0. This is the same as the integral v4x of f, the lowest component. So this is a totally straightforward way of building supersymmetric actions. Just take a few more minutes just so I finish this thing. However, this is a little funny because clearly we want to think about these as the various fields we were talking about before have somehow got to be unified into an object that lives in superspace, clearly. But there's somehow way too many degrees of freedom here. There's lots and lots of fields that we might imagine having. We haven't found our friends that we just started with, our guests, just phi and psi, or f mu nu and lambda. Okay. That's because there's actually an interesting sub-manifold in superspace. An interesting subspace of superspace. So let's look at x alpha alpha dot. So this is our coordinate. But let me look at a new coordinate, which is y plus I theta alpha theta bar alpha dot. Okay. So this is a new coordinate. Let's see how y shifts under supersymmetry. So y. So let's just look at the variation of y alpha alpha dot. Is, well, the variation of x alpha alpha dot was I zeta bar alpha dot theta alpha minus I, minus I plus I zeta alpha theta bar alpha dot. That was of x. Now let's look at the variation of this. This is plus I zeta alpha theta bar alpha dot minus I theta alpha theta bar alpha dot. Right. And if I grasp and flip these guys, I see that these cancel. And so the variation of y is I zeta alpha, 2i zeta alpha theta bar alpha. That's very interesting, because y does not shift under zeta bar. So the zeta bar canceled out of this. So similarly, so if I look at y is x plus I theta bar alpha dot, and y star is x minus theta, alpha dot, then y alpha shifts under zeta, and this shifts under zeta bar. But they don't mix. So this means that if I take a function now, not of the full x theta and theta bar, but if I take a function of y and theta,
just a function of y and theta. This has a well-defined transformation under supersymmetry. Okay? Because the translation in superspace sends this guy into f of, well, y plus something and theta plus something. Well, play the theta plus theta. So there's an interesting holomorphic structure on the superspace. I can have functions of y and theta, or the complex conjugate f dagger of y star and theta bar. Okay. So I can build superfields out of just functions of theta or theta bar. These are our friends, actually. Okay. The simple theories that we just came up with fall in this category. For example, I can take a function phi, which is a function of y and theta, and now I can expand this guy just power series of theta as the lowest component, and there's a conventional root 2 here. Okay. That's the full expansion of phi. Because there's no more, again, there's the theta cubed in higher terms vanish. Now, really, this is really a phi of x theta and theta bar, where y is equal to x plus, you know, I theta bar. But as a function of y and theta, it's just a function. It just has this kind of expansion. And so if I take any function, of y and theta, so in particular, if I take integral d4x, d squared theta, of any function of y and theta, so I can write it as a function of these phi's and theta, it's really any function of y and theta, then this thing is supersymmetric. The reason that's supersymmetric is, note, this is a d4x integral. That depends on y. But I can always, by translational invariant, I can always translate the x variable to the y variable. And then this thing is manifestly supersymmetric. OK? So this is another way. So this is d4x times the theta squared component of these so-called chiral superfields is also supersymmetric. All right, well, here's the simplest chiral superfield. And as I expand it, you see its components are very familiar. There's our complex scalar. Here's the fermion. Okay. Now, who is this? Let's look at dimensions. Phi has dimension 1, so theta has dimensions minus a half. So f has got dimension 2. Okay. Some sort of peculiar object whose dimension is 2. Now, we shouldn't worry so much about it, and we'll see that it has a very natural, does something very nice in a second. But because its mass dimension is 2, ahead of time, we know, how can it appear in the Lagrangian? Can it appear in any complicated way in the Lagrangian at all? Right? It has dimension 2, so the leading thing that it could be is like f star f, which already has dimension 4. Okay? These kind of objects that have high dimension, which can only appear at most quadratically in the action because they have such high dimension, are called auxiliary fields. Okay? So this is an auxiliary field. It's not a physical degree of freedom. And we'll see, its role is really just to make something look very simple. Okay? But anyway, it arises naturally in superspace. So let me just do one superspace exercise, and then we'll have to stop, just in order to recover our friend, the original theory. So clearly I want to take phi
And out of it, I want to build, out of it, I want to build a supersymmetric interaction. Okay? All right? What can I do to get the theory that I started with? I want d phi star d phi plus psi bar I sigma bar d psi. That's what I want to get. Okay? But how am I going to get that out of the superspace Kreckel lattice? Actually, again, this theory has this U1 symmetry that rotates phi and psi. Okay? So that's a symmetry under which the whole superfield goes to e to the I alpha phi. So for instance, you know, what might I want to do? If I'm very naive, I would say, oh, you just taught me how to make supersymmetric things. So let me do phi squared, for example. That's fine, except, first of all, let's just see, again, how units work. Phi has units 1. Okay. So this thing is, the coefficient of this thing is d squared theta is units 1. So this is 1, 2, 3. So the coefficient of this is a mass. So this cannot possibly be the kinetic term. Another thing is that phi itself doesn't have any derivatives in it. There's no derivatives here anywhere. Right? So there's no way this is going to turn into something with derivatives. It's going to give us the kinetic. So I can have dimensionless things here, like lambda phi cube, for example. I can have all kinds of things. We'll come back to this in a second. This is the superpotential. Okay? But it is not the kinetic terms. That's not the kinetic terms because none of these things, this is very, very important, the d squared theta is just a function of phi and not phi dagger. So none of these things can possibly have the U1 symmetry. So what do I have to do? In order to have the U1 symmetry, I have to have a phi dagger and a phi. Okay? That's the only way that whatever I have is going to be U1 invariant. Okay, so this is mass dimension 2 so far. Now, but how am I going to make something supersymmetric out of this? I can't integrate against, this is no longer just a function of theta or theta bar. It is a function of x, theta, and theta bar. Okay? It is a general superfield. So one thing I could do is to just integrate it over d squared theta bar. And that has the advantage too, that this has units 1, 1, so this is 2. The whole thing has dimension 4. But it looks a little strange because there's no derivatives in it. Nonetheless, it has to be right because it has the right units and it has the right symmetries. But let's see how that ends up being right. So here is the supersymmetric Lagrangian is the d squared theta bar is often abbreviated d4 theta, phi dagger phi. So let's try this Lagrangian. Okay. As I said, it looks funny because there's no derivatives in it, but there are actually secretly derivatives in it. The reason is that this is d4 theta. This is phi of y in theta. This is phi dagger of y star in theta bar. But y star is not the same as y. And this is an integral d4x. And neither one of them is x. Okay? So y mu is x mu plus I theta sigma mu theta bar. And y star mu is the other way around. Now let me not, so let me ignore indices and just see how this is going to turn into the kinetic term. Okay? So let's just first look at this guy itself. So phi of x theta and theta bar is phi of y, which is x plus I theta sigma theta bar, plus root 2 theta psi of x plus I theta sigma theta bar, plus theta squared f of x plus I theta sigma theta bar. Okay? Now let's expand this out in in a Taylor series. So the first term is 5x. Then there is something that looks like I theta sigma theta bar d phi. And there's even a term where this thing gets squared, which will then be box phi. Okay, times theta squared theta bar squared. Okay. Now let's look at the next term, is root 2 theta psi of x. Then there's something that looks like root 2 theta theta sigma theta bar d psi. Okay. The next term vanishes because there's too many thetas. Okay. And finally, I have plus theta squared f, and here everything other than the first term just vanishes. Okay? Because there's too many thetas again. So that's what phi looks like. Now I have to take this sucker and multiply by its dagger, find the theta squared theta bar squared coefficient, and call it a day. Okay? Well, let's just do that in our head. So let's take this. When I multiply by its dagger, let's just see who can hit who. So I can pick up from the dagger phi star. But then it's got to pick up someone here with a theta squared theta bar squared. Who is that? It's that guy. Okay. So it picks up a phi star box phi. So integral of d4 theta phi dagger phi, then there's many terms, but there is one term that's phi star box phi. That's a kinetic term for phi. Okay. There's another term where I pick up one of these from each side. Well, that's d phi squared. Still a kinetic term for phi. Okay. There's a term where the psi bar from the other side, which comes with a theta bar, hits the theta bar d psi here. When I strip off the four thetas, I have plus psi bar sigma d psi, the kinetic term for the fermion. And finally, and uniquely, I have the things involving f are an f and an f star. And that's it, because everything else vanishes. So indeed, that's it. So this Lagrange, so in the end, after integrating by a part, this is indeed d4x d phi star d phi plus psi bar I sigma bar d psi plus f star f. Okay. And this is the only novelty, is there seems to be an additional field, but it's not propagating at all, right? Its Lagrangian is purely quadratic. There's no derivatives acting on it. And it's all it could be. Okay. So at this free level, it doesn't seem to be doing very much. But it does something interesting as soon as we add interactions. So in fact, let me just, that will take 1 minute, and then I'll stop. So let's see what happens. So that's what we got out of phi dagger phi. It's comparatively much easier to see what comes out of the general, the other kind of supersymmetric term that we could have was d squared theta times any function of phi. Note this function of phi, not phi dagger, so this is holomorphic in phi. Where for some reason, well, it's not. Okay. Where holomorphic just means a function of phi, not phi dagger, and not anything fancier. All right, let's see what this does. So this is d squared theta w of phi plus root 2 theta psi plus theta squared f. Okay, so let's expand this. This is d squared theta. And I just have to find the theta squared component of this. So this is w of phi. That doesn't have one. Root 2 theta psi d phi w plus theta squared f d phi w. That's all I get to first order. And then to second order, I get plus theta squared psi squared d phi squared of w. And that's it. All the higher orders vanish. So the only things that have a theta squared in them are this term and that term. So what I get schematically is an F d phi w plus a d phi squared w psi psi. Okay. So here is a Yukawa coupling, like we were talking about before. Two fermions times some function of the scalars. Here is something that seems to be an interaction between F and W. But remember before I was saying when we wrote them, when we made our guess for what this supersymmetric Lagrangian should look like, we said that there is this coupling, which had to go like, we had this coupling and this one, and we said if this is H, this has to go like H squared. And it looked a little bit funny that, you know, if these things are related to each other, maybe they should both be H's or something like that. How can we have something with four fields and three fields? How can they be related to each other? Well, we see what is going on now. What's actually happening is so let's say we took the particular case W is equal to H phi Q. Okay? Then what I'm getting here is the d phi squared W psi psi is H phi psi psi. Very good. That's this guy. But then I have my interaction looks like d phi W with F, d phi W F, which is H phi squared F. That also looks like a three-point coupling, right? Here's phi, phi, and F, which I'll represent as this double up. And they're both H. That's H, that's H. Okay. So now this looks very nice. It looks like I've rotated one coupling into the other coupling. Okay. But the fact that this is an auxiliary field, the fact that it appears quadratically means that I can just integrate it out exactly. It's quadratic, so I can just do the path integral over it exactly. Okay? If I do the integral over f exactly, that's equivalent to putting f to its equation of motion because it's purely quadratic. And the equation of motion is f star is equal to minus dw by d phi. So from here I get a potential for phi, which is dw by d phi mod squared. But I can also see it in the pictures here. In pictures here, I have this coupling. I also have this coupling. But this is an auxiliary field, so I can integrate it out. If I integrate it out, I get another local, exactly local coupling. Okay? And that's the phi to the fourth. And we see that indeed, primitively, these three-point couplings are related to each other by supersymmetry. But when I integrate out the auxiliary fields, it looks like I get this kind of structure. Okay. So that's what the auxiliary fields are helping you do. They're helping you keep track of supersymmetry in the most linear possible way. You could get rid of them from the get-go, but it's more convenient to keep them around in order to make the supersymmetry seem more manifest. So the bottom line for this simple theory, and then I'll stop, is now we've learned how to build the supersymmetric Lagrangian. So it's in superspace now, it's phi dagger phi plus w of phi. And the Lagrangian that corresponds to this is d mu phi star d mu phi. And if I integrate out the auxiliary field, I have plus, if you're a little careful, there's a half. Okay. So,
That's it for chiral superfields, and tomorrow I will start off by finishing the story also for vector superfields. So we have the general, the general structure of n equals one supersymmetric theories. Then we'll talk about. I think this will probably be the main, somewhat novel thing about these lectures. Novel in the sense that it's not very standardly out there. Is a nice way of thinking about what supersymmetry breaking and in particular soft terms look like. So the real name of the game. So there's a supersymmetric. Anyway, we'll finish the story. There's a supersymmetric extension of the standard model. But the really interesting thing is what the supersymmetry breaking looks like. So before getting to the MSSM, I will spend some time telling you how to think about soft terms in a general theory nicely. And it turns out that there's a very natural way of thinking about what soft terms are in terms of promoting all the coupling constants in a supersymmetric theory to superfields themselves. And when those superfields have higher components, turn on higher components in them, those are interpreted as soft terms. Soft scalar masses, Gaugino masses, A terms, B terms, and so on. But this way of thinking about the soft terms as background superfields gives you a very powerful way of controlling what the soft terms look like. For example, many of you have probably heard that supersymmetric theories have remarkable renormalization properties. Okay? So we'll talk about the remarkable radiative properties that they have. Various beta functions are exact at one loop, or they're known exactly to all orders, and so on. So we will review those statements supersymmetrically, but then by thinking about the coupling constants as background superfields and extending them into superspace, you immediately, all those exact results about the supersymmetric theory translate into exact results about the softly broken theory. So you don't have to ever remember the renormalization group equations for scalar fields, anything. Everything to do with soft terms, really everything to do with Susie breaking, is completely contained by an appropriate continuation of supersymmetric results in superspace. And anyway, we'll talk about that formalism a little bit, partially because it'll also help us understand finally some of the models of supersymmetry breaking people like to talk about. But most importantly, to get at this issue, which is the real one, not at the heart of this business, of the apparent small amount of tuning, the so-called little hierarchy problem in supersymmetric theories. When we understand how to think about soft terms nicely, we'll be able to phrase what the real issue is there. And anyway, so I'll try to finish the I'll try to get to that already in tomorrow's lecture.